Hello, and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for the Independent Media in Troy, New York. On the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, we are known today as the Stockbridge Muncie community. I'm Darren Kiahi.
And I'm Mark Dunley. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with an overview of the climate impact of the proposed federal debt crisis deal. Then we hear about climate protests, including from dinosaurs, at a national grid conference in Albany today. Later on, we hear about Say Their Names, a community outreach event hosted by Saratoga Black Lives Matter last Friday. Then we have another segment by Bria Barthel with the Landsberg Public Library. And we finish up with Daryl, and we'll be talking about the revival of the Hawaiian culture and language. But first, headlines. So among the state's largest 12 cities, Albany was one of only two that added a few residents in the last year, according to the Census Bureau. Albany's addition of 91 residents boosted the population to 100,826.
The Times Union reported that the city of Albany does not expect to receive additional buses of migrants from New York City over the next few days, while Albany County Executive Dan McCoy said the county might sue New York City to stop additional buses from arriving if Mayor Eric Adams' administration refuses to coordinate its efforts with Albany County. Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan said any pause would give nonprofits and volunteers the time to provide initial legal assistance to asylum seekers who have already arrived.
Gordon Boyd, a Democratic Party candidate for the Saratoga County Board of Supervisors, is charging its Republican chair with potentially harming thousands of Saratoga Race Course backstretch workers when he issued an executive order to prohibit sheltering or transporting migrants and asylum seekers.
The Gazette reports that the promotion of Lieutenant Tyler McIntosh to be in the next chief of the Saratoga Springs Police Department has drawn criticism from local Black Lives Matter activists. McIntosh was one of the six officers named in the case of Darrell Mount, a 21-year-old biracial man who died during a pursuit by police in August 2013.
Residents of Fiddler's Lane and Colony have successfully convinced the town to block Siena College from using their narrow street for trucks as part of the construction of a new science building.
Most of the collection from Ash Plus Chess, a Kingston-based gift and stationery company, were among products removed from Target's Pride collection amid threats and safety concern for the store's employees. Controversy over Target's Pride collection has been driven by misleading videos that included claims that the store was selling gender-affirming swimwear labeled as tuck-friendly, designed for children or in children's sizes.
That's it for headlines.
For our first segment, Mark talks to Eric Waltman of Food and Water, watch about the negative climate impact of the proposed national debt crisis deal.
We're joined today by Eric Waltman, one of the New York State leading organizers on climate, and particularly works for Food and Water Watch. As undoubtedly many of our listeners know, the president and the House Majority Leader, Republican, announced a deal on the debt crisis. I will point out that so-called deal still will need congressional approval, and there are certainly unhappy members in both parties and lots of debates about amendments or how to deal with the situation. But the deal itself largely announced that funding for domestic programs is frozen, while yet more money will be available for the military, plus the IRS can't go after rich tax cheaters. And there's lots of other bad details, many of us would say, that continue to emerge. We're joined by Eric, so that he can provide us initially with an overview of what is sort of concerning about the climate that's in the proposed deal, and we'll do a follow-up question about how does that impact upon New York. So welcome, Eric.
Thank you. Food and Water Watch appreciates the opportunity to join your show. Folks may recall that last year, Food and Water Watch and our allies beat back Senator Manchin's dirty pipeline deal, not once, not twice, but three times. We had thought that the third time would have been the charm, but unfortunately, iterations of Senator Manchin's, dirty pipeline deal, did emerge from the negotiations, as you mentioned, Mark, between President Biden and the House Speaker McCarthy. And so those, machinations resulted in, again, a form of that dirty pipeline deal, which really has devastating climate impacts for New York and for the nation and for the world. It gives the green light to Senator Manchin's pet frack gas project, the controversial Mountain Valley Pipeline. And it contains dangerous permitting provisions that gut environmental protections and would maintain our reliance on dirty fossil fuels. So Food and Water Watch and our allies are very much pressing for Senator Schumer in particular to back what we're calling a clean debt deal, a deal that doesn't contain any provisions that undermine access to food stamps, another concern that's been raised by the deal, and certainly one that doesn't contain any dirty energy poison pills, such as the ones that we beat back not once, not twice, but three times last year, going up against Senator Manchin, who's the coal industry's favorite friend.
So I was certainly remiss in failing to acknowledge that, unfortunately, the deal does expand work requirements, particularly the age requirements for primarily single adults, but, more money for the military, force work for the poor. Now, I understand that Food and Water Watch actually took to the streets out there by Grand Army Plaza, Senator Schumer, a couple of days ago. What was that all about?
Yeah, so Tuesday night, Food and Water Watch and our allies and New York Communities for Change and 350 Brooklyn and a host of other organizations had 100 plus people outside of Senator Schumer's apartment in Park Slope, Brooklyn. We had a 20-foot tall mock oil rig. We had a bunch of wonderful banners, garnered some tremendous media coverage as we literally took to the streets, blocking Senator Schumer's, street in an effort to encourage him to block the dirty pipeline deal, to block the dirty permitting deal. As folks are probably well aware, he's not only New York's own senator, but he is the Senate Majority Leader. He's been complicit, unfortunately, in supporting Senator Manchin's, pet frack gas project, the Mountain Valley Pipeline, which, if folks aren't aware, it's a very controversial project. It stretches 303 miles between West Virginia and Virginia. The communities have been fighting it for years. It would have a devastating impact, on our climate if it were to be built. It's proposed by hundreds and hundreds of frontline communities. And the statistic is that this one pipeline would be responsible for emissions equivalent to 26 coal plants. So Senator Schumer, if he doesn't fight back against this deal, it would be a climate catastrophe. So we need Senator Schumer to call for a clean debt deal. Again, one that doesn't punish low-income communities and one that doesn't devastate our climate.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate for a moment on the issue of permitting reform. Obviously, everybody's concerned about, greenwashing, greenlighting fossil fuel projects. At the same time, in New York, it used to take 10 years to get approval for wind and solar renewable energy. The governor Cuomo tried to pass a law, tried to cut it down to two. I remember talking to New York City mayor's office a number of years ago, trying to get them to buy 100% renewable energy, and particularly buy offshore wind, which needed to be developed. And they just looked at me, Mark, we can't wait 10 years. So how do you solve permitting reform?
Mark, this deal does nothing to advance the construction transmission lines. It does nothing to advance the permitting renewable energy. That was put on the table to be discussed later. This was horrible deal making, frankly, on the part of President Biden. He gave away the store. Everything positive that could come out of genuine permitting reform did not happen. This really just guts environmental protections as they come as applied to fossil fuel projects. And again, specifically green lights, the controversial Mountain Valley Pipeline. This is not a climate deal. This is a step back for the climate. And we need perhaps some permitting reform that fast tracks the production of renewable energy. This deal does not do that. It does not do that at all.
Now, if you talk to President Biden, as I'm sure you do on a regular basis, okay. I mean, he would argue that, hey, I've done more for climate than any president in history. How much money, I gave. Since the Democrats, starting with Biden, claim they want to do the right thing on climate, why are they so often doing the wrong thing?
Well, you could point to all the fossil fuel money that the likes of Senator Manchin as well as Senator Schumer are getting. These industries remain, very powerful in particular states. And, I'd love to, be in President Biden's shoes, but I think this is indefensible.
Okay. So we got about 90 seconds left. So sort of a two-part question. Probably an earlier question, but are there particularly any unique impacts to New York from this deal? And if people wish to express their opinion to, President Biden or other elected officials, do you guys have any type of mechanism to assist in that process?
All right, part one. Well, at the risk of saying the obvious, the climate impacts of the Mountain Valley Pipeline alone would have consequences for New York. I mean, we're all impacted by climate change, no matter where we live, by projects just like this, just about anywhere. But absolutely, it would gut provisions of the National Environmental Policy Act, which is the landmark legislation that requires environmental reviews of projects. It freezes funding for the Environmental Protection Agency, which obviously has climate and environmental impacts for New York. In terms of putting the heat on Senator Schumer, Food and Water Watch does have a hotline, 866-961-4293. I'll repeat that. It's 866-961-4293. We encourage folks to visit the Food and Water Watch website where they can learn more and take action and sign up and get involved.
Again, what's that website?
It's foodandwaterwatch.org, www.foodandwaterwatch.org. Again, the hotline of Schumer is 866-961-4293.
We've been talking with Eric Wellman, Food and Water Watch, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Now, I'll note that the first vote in the House will take place actually on today, Wednesday night. In an earlier vote today, by a vote of 241 to 187, 52 Democrats joined to say yes, overcoming the opposition of 29 Republicans. So it looked like this will be passing, at least in the House, with a lot of Democratic votes. And in breaking news, in the Schoharie limousine case, the judge sentenced the convicted defendant, Noman Hussein, the operator of the limousine company, to a maximum of 5 to 15 years in prison, 2 weeks after the jury found him guilty of 20 counts of second-degree manslaughter on the crash in Schoharie.
In place of our normal peace bucket, we hear about why climate activists, including some dressed as dinosaurs, were protesting Wednesday at National Grid's electrification conference at the Renaissance Hotel across from the Capitol.
Wednesday, May 31st, was a busy day down at the state capitol. I covered three events. part two, we'll cover the Criminal Justice News Conference for Clean Slate and the Housing for All rally for Good Cause Eviction. This segment focused on actions at National Grid's Electrification Conference at the Renaissance Hotel across from the Capitol. Groups were protesting National Grid for not doing more to transition rapidly to clean energy. A top priority is the New York Heat Act, which would direct state agencies like the Public Service Commission to incorporate the new climate law into their policies. In particular, groups want to end the hundreds of millions of dollars annually that ratepayers are charged to subsidize fossil fuels, including expansion, otherwise known as the 100-foot rule. The SAFE Act would also cap utility bills for low and moderate income households at 6% of income. A rogue group of dinosaurs did make an appearance, accompanied by corporate lobbyists doling out money to thank National Grid for their efforts. We hear from Mary Finneran, one of the dinosaurs, Pete Looker, one of the corporate lobbyists, climate youth activist and college student Katie Marshall, and Betta Broad of New Yorkers for Clean Power. Earlier today, Mary Finneran dressed up as a dinosaur. So, Mary, what was the point of being a dinosaur?
The point of being a dinosaur is that National Grid is hosting the Electrification Summit. And we think that that's a little bit hypocritical, and because they are greenwashing everything. And so we think that dinosaurs, who are the source, a partial source of fossil fuels, would be a good symbol to show the hypocrisy of National Grid.
Are there, you know, particular issues? I know this is the end of the legislative session that you all are focused upon, trying to get the legislature to pass.
Well, there's the New York heat bill, and there was a group of people who were doing an action about that. And the New York heat would stop the 100-foot rule. It would actually cut down. It would make heating bills, fuel bills, 6% of what the people, for people of mid and lower income. And it would just provide means to get off of fossil fuels. And we're really supporting that bill. But the dinosaurs were separate. The handlers, the dinosaurs really needed handlers because they were quite rambunctious. And also it was kind of hard for us to see. But we were handing out money that was from National Grid to Kathy Hochul, $1 billion. We had all kinds of information.
What was the $1 billion symbolic of?
It's just symbolic that National Grid will pay just about anything to get people to allow their fossil fuel interests to continue.
And why dinosaur?
Well, because dinosaurs are fossil fuels. That's the source of the fossil fuels, was when the dinosaurs were alive, and also they went extinct. So we were pushing an extinction for all, that if we continue with the fossil fuels, everybody will go extinct, and the dinosaurs want some company in their extinction.
There have been certainly misinformation campaigns being organized by various fossil fuel interests. Has National Grid been part of that, or people here at the Electrification Conference?
I am sure. I can't.
So what has the disinformation campaign been about?
The disinformation campaign is about the fact that they're saying that, they're going to be eliminating fossil fuels or backing off on fossil fuels, when actually a lot of their plans would increase or at least sustain or maintain the fossil fuel industry from going on.
So is there any sound effects that went with this, Mary?
That was the pterodactyl. Of course, we can't know what pterodactyls actually sound like, but I thought that was probably close.
Thank you, Mary Finneran. So we're now joined by Pete Looker, who also took part in the demonstration. But, Peter, I understand you were not dressed up as a dinosaur for some reason.
No, I was dressed up with my three-piece suit as a lobbyist, the ones that actually directly give the money to the politicians.
And were you handing out any money at the Renaissance Electrification event?
I handed out some money, and I handed out a couple of checks. we do a lot of it, not just today, but we do it all the time. So we gave $350,000 to the politicians on in National Grid to defeat the electrification policy this year. And we gave $165,000 in campaign contributions to New York politicians in the last 6 years. Governor Hochul happens to be our biggest recipient. So she's got a big pocket, and we've been filling her pockets for her campaign.
Now, while the legislature is trying to close out the session and not apparently doing much on climate, it was sort of interesting that Governor Hochul went around the state instead to promote a listening tour about the Environmental Bond Act, which already was passed. Do we need more money for climate than what is in the Environmental Bond Act?
Yes, we obviously need to do more, and we need to do it faster. That's my humble opinion, because that's been my opinion for the last 30 years.
And are there a couple of things that you particularly would like to see the legislature do before they go home for their six-month vacation?
New York Heat, the Heat Act now, that would be one. But.
Thank you, Pete Looker. We have a return appearance by Mary Finneran.
Just one quick thing. One way that National Grid is showing their hypocrisy is even though they are saying they want to electrify everything, they are one of two clients for the Iroquois natural gas pipeline that they want to expand the amount of gas going through to get more gas into New York City. So that's just one point where they aren't pushing for the electrification in New York City, but they are pushing to get more gas because they say that it's needed. Whereas the PSC said that New York City doesn't need gas at this time when they denied National Grid's vaporizer plans to vaporize liquid natural gas to put it into pipelines for Brooklyn. So that's actually two examples of where National Grid is being hypocritical.
Thank you, Mary. We next hear from Katie Marshall. Get up at 4:30 a.m. this morning from Rochester to come. What motivated you to come and sort of protest National Grid?
First of all, it was super fun to be a dinosaur. We don't always get to have as much fun doing demonstrations and protests as we did today being dinosaurs. But in general, I mean, I am 24 and I'm in grad school and I'm like, don't really believe that we have a future going past the next 10 years. And so that's what really motivates me to do this work in general. This protest was just a good one that I had time to do. I just finished a semester. And, you know, National Grid and other fossil fuel lobbyists have the money in this fight, and the money gets them in the door, and they get the ear and the support of politicians. And so we have to fight back in whatever crazy creative ways we can come up with.
So what would you like the politicians to do about climate at this point?
Here in New York, the best way for us in the future is to pass the New York Heat Act in the budget and to make sure that we're transitioning to electrification in buildings and in vehicles and building up the grid around that.
My name's Betta Broad. I'm the Director of Advocacy and Organizing at Association for Energy Affordability and Campaign Director at New Yorkers for Clean Power. And here today because we're doing everything we can to enable a timely, managed, equitable transition of our building sector, to electrify our buildings, to make them as energy efficient as possible and get off fossil fuels as quickly as we can with protections for the most vulnerable New Yorkers so they're not paying any more than 6% of their income on their energy bills. And that is what this transition is all about, protecting New Yorkers, making it equitable, and protecting our climate for future generations.
And you have a website if people want more information?
nyforcleanpower.org.
Thank you very much. This was Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I will mention that while Pete Looker was a corporate lobbyist today, I do remember 30 years ago during one of the first protests against the James Bay Hydro-Quebec project, Peter dressed up as a 6-foot beaver and actually met with the governor's secretary for energy and the environment. And we will continue to cover the closing days of the legislative session, and particularly around climate issues. For those just tuning in, I'm Mark Dunlay.
And I'm Darren Kiahi. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOC-LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOG-LP 92.7 FM Troy, and WOS-LP 98.9 FM Schenectady.
And we are streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. If you like what you hear, you can support this program by telling a friend. Find today's stories and more at mediasanctuary.org.
During the Say Their Names community outreach event held last Friday, leaders from Saratoga Black Lives Matter spoke to locals about voting, the group's purpose, and remembering the lives lost. This report was produced by Alicia Washington.
In today's report, I follow up my previous segment titled Awareness Groups in Congress Park to focus on some of the speeches given by the Saratoga Black Lives Matter leaders at the Say Their Names community outreach event. Food, music, and coloring activities were available. Let's listen in.
Black lives
matter!
Black lives
matter!
Guys, I'm Chandler. Thank you for coming here. So, of course, I just want to start out by saying that y'all need to drop the charges on me and my brother.
Drop them charges!
Drop the charges!
Drop
the charges!
Drop the charges!
Drop the charges! Daryl Mout, it's been 9 years. 9 years. Do you understand what that does to a family? The turmoil that this has put into the family. They still don't have answers. But what they do see is people in the streets putting their lives on the line for Daryl Mount and still not getting any answers and still not having any help. No one wants to do anything for Daryl's family. There has never been a direct apology to his family. And that's not right. At the end of the day, we will continue to be in the streets until we get justice for Daryl Mount. And I hope that y'all are still behind me every single time, because I know that numbers dwindle, but that doesn't mean that our voices still aren't important. And what happens in Saratoga isn't important. It is important, all the way down to who we elect and put inside of city council seats. It is important. So you should be showing up not only to Saratoga BLM events, but you should also be showing up to the polls. When there's petitions out for people like Kristen Dart, you sign them.
Woo!
It doesn't take much. It's a signature.
We are here to say no more.
No more?
No more!
Bobby Ford should be here. Daryl Mount should be here. Daniel Prude should be here. Elijah McClain should be here. Sandra Bland should be here. Jordan Neely should be here, but they're not. So we must fight for them to continue to make sure that what happened to them doesn't happen to anybody else under our watch. So we cannot be superheroes. We can't be all over the country, although we have been, but we can't be everywhere at once. What we can do as Saratogians, because that's what we are, we're from Saratoga, we can take care of our community. We can let our community know that we are not having that here. We will not have any police brutality here. We will not allow racism to go unchecked here. We will not go into the flagpole and shake hands after you call somebody a racist name. We will not shake your hand after you beat me. I will not shake your hand after you smack me. I will not shake your hand after you spit in my face. I'm gonna fight back. How far have we come in a community where activists are still being attacked because of speech, still being attacked because of the tone of their voices? Don't let you grab a microphone. You might catch two charges. This is the city that we live in. We come to meetings quietly, asking, begging for change, begging for closure of people's families, begging for the abuse to stop, and trying to bridge the divide that's between the community and the city. And what do? We have people who run under false pretenses, use our traumas, use our vulnerabilities against us. Because we were happy with Jim won, weren't we? Because we thought for once, maybe we actually have a chance at some change. Maybe we are creating what we set out to create, which is equity in our community, less division in our community, and the racism in our community, discrimination in our community. But what do we have? We have people charged right now who have families, children, facing time that they can actually go to jail for. Once again, is that going to, this is my 18th charge. Beat all 16 before then. Yeah. Do you think that this is gonna deter me?
No.
Gonna quiet me?
No.
Gonna calm the waters?
No.
Are they preaching a divide?
No.
They're creating a division that they want to create to use it for political gain. We heard how the people view the unhoused in Saratoga Springs. The same people who don't believe in hate and say that we are people who stir up hate and terrorists. The same people who feed the unhoused. The same people who try to clothe the unhoused. The same people who fight for shelters for the unhoused are the terrorists.
That ain't right.
That ain't right.
We had people come into city council meetings saying how terrified they are of homeless people. These are the narratives that they built so that Jordan Neely's can happen. And people can applaud it and say, you are right on, you are righteous. You are a hero for doing that. You are a true American hero for doing that. So to make it even more simple for people who want to know what Black Lives Matter Saratoga Springs is fighting for, we're fighting for change. We're fighting for something different. We don't want the norms. I don't want my kids dealing with what I dealt with when I was a kid. What many elders in our community tell us that they dealt with as a kid. The elders who continue to say how much they support us. They can't come out in the streets. They can't march, but they can let us know that they are so proud of the things that we are doing as young people, that some of them wish they had the courage to do the same as we are doing right now. We are steadfast. We are keeping our heads down and straight and onto the path for change, equity, and inclusivity within our community. We refuse to be the outsiders within our own community. We refuse to be pushed out anymore by our own community. Our backs turned by our own community, silenced by the very people who we pay and put into power. So it's election year, very important, hence why you see things firing up, why charges are being brought, why activists are wanting to be silenced, why a public safety commissioner that's here to keep people safe decided to vote against a resolution that creates change and acknowledges the wrong past doings of our community. We can never move forward unless we acknowledge our past. But the reason why we are here right now is because of us fighting for these people's lives. And people are building false narratives that are dangerous. It's dangerous to say that we are violent. Would you want us to be another Jordan Neely, another Daryl Mount, another Bobby Ford, who we know who didn't shoot himself, another Breonna Taylor? We have people fighting against banning no-knock warrants after we see what no-knock warrants does to both police, bystanders, and the people who are there going to arrest. They are harmful and dangerous. And although we are happy with the resolution that was passed, that's not a ban on no-knock warrants. We ask that you continue your fight with us, continue supporting us, whether that means coming out in the streets with us, whether that means donating to the free refrigerator in front of the Elks Lodge on Beekman Street, whether that means coming to our mutual aid events and donating clothes, whether that means sending your kids to the youth safe space that we have. So I just mentioned a few things. We do community events in which we feed community. We do a community poetry events in which we try to enrich the community with arts. We have art events in which we try to enrich the community with arts. We have GOTV events, which are get out to vote event, to enrich our community with their knowledge of the voting system and polling system and our government style that we have in Saratoga Springs. We have direct action events to let people know that we're not playing any games about change in our community.
We encourage people to be engaged in school board meetings to know what's going on in your child's school or your, even if you don't have no children, in your community member schools, where your tax money is going to. What are they doing with these children? Education is key, as we know.
We just heard some of the speeches that occurred on the day, and we were listening to group leader and activist Lexis Figueroa and his sister Chandler Hickenbottom, who is in charge of youth outreach and the group's Saratoga Youth's Safe Space program. To learn more, see the links in the show description. This has been Alicia Washington for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
And so that was a Say the Names community outreach event held last Friday by Saratoga Black Lives Matter. I will note, as reported earlier, that Lieutenant Tyler McIntosh, who's been selected to be the next chief of the Saratoga Springs Police Department, was one of the six officers named in the case of Darryl Mount, who was a 21-year-old biracial man with apparent mental health issues, who died during a pursuit by the police in August 2013.
In Brea Bartholomew's Troy Library segment, Michael Gregg from Troy Public Library's Lansingburg branch, in honor of June 1st, Global Parents' Days, recommends four novels that present different takes on families.
This is Bria Barthel for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm back once again at the Troy Lansingburg branch of Troy Public Library, but with a different guest presenter. Michael Gregg is filling in for Lori Dreyer this time. Michael, welcome back to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Why, thank you so much for having me.
And I understand that you took a theme of Global Parents Day on June 1st, so hopefully we'll get this in sort of before or near there. What's your first book?
So the first book I have is called French Exit by Patrick DeWitt. Came out a few years ago. It's sort of a bone-dry comedy of manners that's featuring a dysfunctional mother-son relationship. That's sort of the running theme for these books. So French Exit follows Frances. She's a once wealthy but quickly running out of money widow. And she decides that she would rather die before all her money runs out. So she decamps to a friend's Paris apartment for what she believes to be her final days, taking her vapid, dependent man-child son and their cat with them. And though the premise is very dark, it's a hilarious novel. DeWitt's got this like arch but very unfussy prose style. And I laughed my whole way through this book. I really enjoyed it.
It's a comedy about somebody who wants to die.
Yes, but I assure you that it's funny. You know, in tone, I would almost compare it to like a Wes Anderson film, if that tracks. Like it's whimsical in a sense, but it's also very dry, and it's sort of a study of like, you know, a silly take on privilege in a way.
Great, and that's French Exit. And the next one?
The next one I have is called The Nest by Cynthia Dupree Sweeney. I think that's how you say it. And this novel, it's about parents in a sense, but more than that, it's about the legacy that parents leave behind. This book is about these four very privileged siblings in New York City. And the whole book is about them squabbling over their inheritance, which they lovingly refer to as The Nest. So it's another one of these portrayals of like upper class privilege. But it's got a zany take on it. I believe the author, her husband is a writer for Conan O'Brien. And it reminded me a lot of like sort of the Arch family comedies you might see on television over the last 10 or 15 years. It made me think a lot about Succession on HBO, which just ended a lot. Another family squabble, but this one's a little lighter.
For my book club, I've been reading Jane Austen at Home. And so that idea of dysfunctional families and squabbles over inheritances is really echoing my book. Okay, and then the third one.
So we've got The Good Father by Noah Hawley. This is not funny at all. the novel follows Dr. Paul Allen, a successful rheumatologist enjoying suburban bliss with his second wife and family. And his life gets thrown upside down when his bright but troubled son from his first marriage attempts to assassinate a presidential candidate.
And for some reason, that's not a comedy.
No, there's unfortunately not a ton of humor in this one. It's got the feel of a thriller, even though the identity of the culprit is never really in doubt. And it mostly follows Paul, the father. He investigates the crime and sort of struggles with his own guilt and culpability for the act. But it also intersperses the perspective of the son as he's awaiting trial. And there are all these little diversions into explorations of other historical assassinations. So I think it'll hook history buffs, but also lovers of a good suspense novel. And then it's also got that poignant father-son relationship at its center.
Great. So that's French Exit, The Nest, The Good Father, and next.
Our last one is News of the World by Paulette Giles, which some of you may know got turned into a film a few years ago with Tom Hanks. But I much prefer the novel, which follows Captain Jefferson Kyle Kidd. He's an elderly veteran of, I believe, the War of 1812. And he ekes out a living sort of as an orator, traveling from town to town and reading from the major newspapers of the day for a small admission fee. And after one of these engagements, he very suddenly finds himself tasked with returning Joanna, a young German immigrant who had been kidnapped and adopted by a Kiowa tribe, to her distant relatives in Texas. So despite the language barrier and this harrowing set of Old West circumstances, this captain character and his charge pretty quickly develop like a grandfather-grandchild rapport as they move along the trail in the Old West.
Sounds very interesting. And again, that's News of the World. Before we started, you said that these were all books that you have read yourself.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Would you rank them at all, or do they have different feels? Or
yeah, I mean, I tend to, I guess I prefer the funny to the serious, but I think this is a good mix of both. Ranking is sort of a difficult. My favorite is probably French Exit. I'm a really big fan of Patrick DeWitt's work. I would highly recommend his other novels, too. He's got a great Western called The Sisters Brothers that is really worth a read. And The Good Father really made an impact on me, too. It's a very interesting psychological drama and a thriller and a little, it's a little bit of everything. I really enjoyed that book.
Great. Now, besides books, the libraries do a whole lot of other stuff. And so I know you've got a few things that are coming up that you want to highlight for our listeners.
Sure. So one of the first things I think would really interest your listeners is that the Lansingburg branch, we've recently started doing a seed library. So you can stop into the branch and you can, quote unquote, check out some seeds that you can use in your garden. And then the idea is at the end of the season, you can harvest some of the seeds that have been regenerated, return them to the library, and then somebody else next year can grow their own garden with those seeds.
But you're not required to bring in seeds.
You are not required to bring in seeds, no. For this, we're launching this pilot program just this year. Please come on down, see if you can grab something that will pop up in your garden.
When I first heard the idea of a seed library, I was imagining librarians trying to stamp the due date on each of the seeds. Which is quite the image, but I guess you don't do that.
I'm afraid not, but if only you could have seen us stuffing all the little seeds into tiny packets and then affixing little labels on each one. It was a very library task, I can assure you.
Okay, and what else do you have?
Well, it's always important this time of year to plug our summer reading program, the annual summer reading program. We've got tons of events coming up, and we are doing summer reading both online and in person this year. So our adult summer reading program, you can sign up right on our website, track your reading. We've got prizes from local businesses, lots of badges you can earn. And then the children's summer reading program, you can either sign up online or in person. And we've got tons of events that are coming up with the summer reading theme.
Now, the summer reading program where you track your books, I know they're doing that at the main branch also. Are they separate programs? Can you only count your books once? How does that work?
So for the main branch and the Lansingburg branch, it is all one program. So if you're logging your reading online at one branch, or if you're logging it in person in one branch, that counts towards the other branch.
Okay. What else do you have?
Well, I always love to plug our Thursday program, Shorts Out Loud, as a musician myself. This is one of our long-running programs. So Thursday evenings throughout the summertime, we will be alternating between the main branch and our Lansingburg branch. You can come for a half an hour of music by one of our wonderful local musicians, and then we will have someone read a short story afterwards. It is one of our most popular programs every year, and I'm very excited for the lineup this year.
So it's music first and then a short story.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have guests reading the short stories? Who does the readings?
So the readings are library patrons for the most part. And then the musicians, we try to feature people from our local community as well.
And that's Thursday evenings?
Thursday evenings at 6 o'clock throughout the summer.
At the Lansingburg branch.
Half of them are in Lansingburg and half of them are at our downtown branch. You can check our website to confirm the location.
And that website is thetroylibrary.org. Be sure to use the word the or you'll be in a totally different state. So those are all great activities. What else you got?
Well, we've got our running programs here at the Lansingburg branch. We do chair yogas on Monday and adult yoga on Wednesdays. We've got our various book clubs. We have a mystery book club the first Tuesday of the month and our contemporary adult fiction book club the last Wednesday of every month. We've got our knitting program, Fiber in the Morning, a knitting circle at 10 a.m. on Thursdays. We've got our Brick Builders, which is our children's yoga group that meets at 3:30 on Monday afternoons. And you can always check the Troy Library website for all of our continuing programming.
For people who haven't been to the Lansingburg branch, remind us where it is.
So we are right in the heart of Lansingburg on 114th Street, right around the corner from Snowman's Ice Cream. It's a big, beautiful yellow building that's hard to miss, and I hope to see you here. 2714th Street.
2714th Street. And again, this is Bria Barthel for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, talking with Michael Gregg, Library Associate at the Troy Lansingburg branch. Thanks a lot, Michael.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So for more details on books and activities, you can see www.thetroylibrary.org. And the four books that Michael Gregg recommended were French Exit, A Tragedy of Manners by Patrick DeWitt, The Nest by Cynthia Dupree-Sweeney, The Good Father by Noah Hawley, and News of the World by Paulette Giles. So to finish up tonight's show, we're going to talk with our co-host, Darren Kiai, who is joining us in North Troy at Hudson Mohawk Magazine for about a month. He is Hawaiian, a culture that has been suppressed by colonists and the rest of America. And we wanted to take this opportunity to ask about the revival of the Hawaiian culture. So, Darren, what would you like listeners to know about you?
My name is Darren Kiahi. Born and raised in Hawaii. I am an artist. I play music and dance and perform a lot. And it's been really nice being in Troy.
You know, what's something about the history of Hawaii? You know, most Americans view it as a place to go on honeymoons and stuff like that, way out in the ocean. You know, where did Hawaii, you know, come from, and who are the native people of Hawaii?
So the native Hawaiian people have been around, you know, for a long time before it was discovered. And this is a very loving culture. You know, we love the ocean, fishing, and just our dance and our music and our culture is very strong. And I guess that's why a lot of people like to come to Hawaii for like honeymoons, because it's very special with the culture.
You didn't mention surfing, which I believe is something that is particularly important to you.
Oh yeah, I've been surfing since I was a kid. And yeah, it's one of the most funnest things to do in Hawaii. And I still have the same passion of the ocean. Still in my age today, 36.
So I understand only recently has the Hawaiian language, you know, really been brought back more into the mainstream, you know, society there. I understand your kids have grown up speaking Hawaiian. What are some of the difference that you're noticing between, you know, how you grew up and how your kids are growing up?
Yeah, the difference, you know, like, yeah, me growing up, I didn't really know the language, only like from what I would hear from, you know, from songs or stuff. But like my kids now, they know the language and you can hear them speaking to their friends and they're very smart. And I think because of the, like now that they have that Hawaiian language, they have their natural, you know, their natural language that they know.
I'll admit my knowledge of the Hawaiian culture is limited, but I have a recollection that a queen was very, at some point, very much a major figure.
Oh, yeah.
Do people grow up, you know, sort of still connecting to that sort of older, you know, government or society?
Yeah, so we still have like we still have protests, you know, that you're talking about Queen Liliuokalani. That was the queen that she did. She, when they were trying to overthrow Hawaii, she stayed in her, she was imprisoned in her own palace. That was kind of bad to say. It was the Iolani Palace. And she didn't back down no matter what they did. And she said, I'm not going to leave. And that was her way of, you know, fighting for the Hawaiian people. So we still actually that was in 1893. So in 1993, when I was only like 6 years old, they had 100-year anniversary since the Queen did that. And I remember that day when they had that.
Well, you also mentioned before we get on the air that you had participated in some of the demonstrations that took place to a telescope being built on a top of a mountain, which was indigenous land, pretty sacred. What was that demonstration about and how has that been resolved?
They had a big protest. I was actually there on Big Island. It's that mountain's called Mauna Kea. It's one of the highest mountains in Hawaii. It sometimes even snows up there when the weather gets cold. But big protests. There was actually a bunch of Hawaiian people that got arrested. And not only for that day, just for a couple hours. Blocking the machines to try to drive past to build the telescopes. So yeah, they did a really good job of protesting, and there's a lot of culture up there. They're doing singing and dancing on that mountain.
And why was that mountain important?
Well, the mountain is important because it's sacred, and like the water, right, all comes from, well, the volcano actually. Because Big Island is actually the only island that still has active volcanoes.
In many countries, you know, the local indigenous, you know, population has been, you know, decimated by the colonialists and often relegated to a very secondary or even third, you know, level role in their society, often much more economically deprived, I guess. How does that, you know, play out? You know, are the more native Hawaiians as well off as the more, you know, those from mainstream or not mainstream from mainland America who settled there?
I know for me, I just like, you know, as long as you respect the culture, you know, it's just like understanding it. And because I have a lot of friends that are, that are from the mainland that move to Hawaii. And Hawaii is actually a pretty expensive place to live. You know, they call it the price to live in paradise because it's an expensive place to live. So I just feel as long as you respect the culture, then it's all good.
Mm-hmm. I will say I had a housemate who suddenly took off one morning and moved to Hawaii.
Oh.
And what was interesting was that he was living on the beach and collecting food stamps, And Ashley was very much, he said, supported by the local government because they saw anybody receiving food stamps as a way to bring, you know, federal dollars back in, you know, to the local economy. You know, how dependent, if at all, is the Hawaiian economy, you know, based on the federal government expenditures or anything? Or how does that work?
Yeah, because, I mean, in Hawaii, there's obviously, there is a lot of, like, you know, homeless and poor people, you know, that can't afford, that need, you know, EBT and that stuff and the benefits. Because, you know, it is expensive. So people that don't make that much money, they have a hard time, you know, keeping up with.
So when you go back to Hawaii, you know, what will you be doing there?
I do construction, actually. I do drywall and metal framing. I've been doing that like 16 years. And that's like, construction is really a big business in Hawaii. A lot of, you know, people do that, building, construction.
So one of the things I personally cover, but the station covers as well, is climate change. Hawaii is obviously a tropical country. Mm-hmm. What is the concern about climate change in Hawaii?
Climate change, yeah, it doesn't really, I mean, Hawaii almost stays the same. Like, it gets a little cold in December, you know. And I think with the climate change is always the sea is rising. So people that live, you know, people that live on beach houses, the water line is always rising slowly and slowly, mm-hmm. you know.
Right. And also one thing about climate change, when it puts more heat into the ocean, it also puts more power. And so things like hurricanes become, you know, more powerful and devastated. If people want to find out more about Hawaiian culture, what are some good things to they can look at? We need to wrap up, but if you have one or two quick things.
There is one called Hawaii News Now. It's kind of like pretty, they have like pretty much all the news about Hawaii. Hawaii News Now. They have like pretty much everything, Instagram, internet. But that would be probably the best way to find out about Hawaii.
We need to wrap up. I'm Mark Dunley. We want to thank all the volunteers who made today's episode possible, including Bria Barthel and Alicia Washington, and of course Darren. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community and is supported by independent donations. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org.
We want to hear from you. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Media Sanctuary, or send us an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org.